one of the most interesting subjects in the 20th century of United States history has to be what happened in Dallas in 1963 as to what happened with John F. Kennedy. I'll tell you a book that really helped me to understand what was going on in that climate, the climate that produced Lee Harvey Oswald and the boiling cauldron that was Dallas in that time, is a book called Dallas 1963 that I'd like to recommend to you here at TonyBasilio.com and the Tony Basilio Show. One of the co-authors of the book from 12 Publishing, the book's called Dallas 1963. Stephen L. Davis is now joining us. He, along with Bill Minutaglio, co-authored this work that I want to recommend to you. Stephen is the curator of the Whitliff Collection at Texas State University. And Stephen, the first thing I want to do to you today is welcome you to our program, and great to have you on board.
Oh, thanks for inviting me, Tony. It's a pleasure to join you.
Why does this subject grab so many people, do you feel like, the subject of Dallas in that time period and John F. Kennedy?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think it has a lot to do with the mythological appeal of John Kennedy. And Jackie was really onto something when she talked about Camelot. And just this kind of shining moment as we view it in American history with this young, intelligent couple, beautiful couple. And of course, as we've seen in recent years, it wasn't quite what the image made out to be, but we still have that image in our hearts somewhere. I think all of us carry that image with us inside. And so to see that kind of tragic end, it's a hard thing to get over.
You guys, as you put this work together, the title Dallas 1963 sort of suggests that we're going to get a look at what happened in 1963, but you back up. You start the book actually in 1960, and it reads like a history of what was going on in Dallas at the time, some of the key players, a lot of colorful characters on the scene there in 1960. Why did you guys decide to go back to the year 1960?
To understand what happened in November of 1963, we felt it was really important for people to understand what the city of Dallas was like. That time, Dallas was known nationally as the most rabid anti-Kennedy city in the country. It was the home of a very extreme, vocal, virulent Kennedy opposition. And these were people who weren't just politically opposed to Kennedy, but they considered him a traitor against the United States. He was denounced as a socialist, and communist, and all these other things. And so we focused on these key people in Dallas who created that climate of hatred. And to do that properly, we really had to set context and go back and show who they were. We had, in 1960, one of the people we talk about is H.L. Hunt, who was, at that time, the richest man in the world, the oil billionaire from Dallas, who was gleefully spending his fortune to fund these attacks on John Kennedy. And people may recall that part of the history of the 1960 election was Kennedy's religion and the fact that he was Catholic. And it was H.O. Hunt that was spending the money to distribute these attacks against JFK's religion across the country. And, he was just one of this kind of cabal of really kind of amazing, outsized characters.
And Dallas is known for those folks, or I guess the state of Texas is known for larger-than-life type folks. There are several others aside from Hunt. One of them who comes to mind, who you do quite a bit of research on and you elaborate on his story, is Walker, who ends up becoming a part of the Lee Harvey Oswald saga as well.
Yeah, you're so right to mention him, because General Edwin Walker is really one of the fascinating, overlooked people in American history. He's the guy who basically had been relieved of his military command by John Kennedy. Walker commanded the 24th Infantry Division and had been indoctrinating his troops with far-right John Birch Society propaganda, violation of what you're supposed to be doing in the military. And when Kennedy basically forced him out of the army, General Walker received a hero's welcome there. He was greeted in this huge public ceremony, thousands of people cheering him, the mayor of Dallas presenting him with the keys to the city and the Stetson hat. And Walker made Dallas the home of his anti-Kennedy campaign. And whereas people like H.L. Hunt and the newspaper publisher in Dallas, Ted Dealey, and other people were doing these kind of rhetorical attacks against Kennedy, Evan Walker kind of took on a more violent edge.
Mm-hmm.
And he led the deadly riots at the University of Mississippi when James Meredith tried to enroll as the first black person. He's the guy who led the attack on United Nations Ambassador Adlai Stevenson when he came to Dallas a month before Kennedy's own visit. And this antagonism between Kennedy and General Walker was very personal. And you can hear it reflected in a lot of these Oval Office recordings that we got access to where Kennedy denounces Walker. And as you mentioned, Walker, who became kind of the leader of America's far right and was seen as the real challenger to Kennedy, became a target for Lee Harvey Oswald, who stalked Walker in Dallas in April 1963 and had a really good shot at the general's head. What happened is the bullet hit the window frame. It just sent it off its trajectory by just a hair, so that passed through the general's hair instead of into his head. It's one of those little-known episodes of American history. First assassination attempt of Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah, and what's really interesting, as we visit today with a co-author of the book, and I want to encourage you to get this, Dallas 1963. If you're a Kennedy assassination buff or you have an interest in American history and this subject, I'm telling you, this is a great book. It came out October of last year, and I'm sure it's available at Amazon.com and where other fine books are sold from 12 Publishing. The thing that's ironic about this episode and how it's been pretty underreported throughout the last 50 years, Lee Oswald set up that assassination down to the T. The assassination attempt, I should say, of Walker, not assassination. He wasn't successful. But he had all the time in the world. You guys talk about in your book how there was some sort of service going on. He had to wait for the right opportunity. But certainly it wasn't as compacted a time as it was when he was getting a shot at Kennedy. But he misfired there. That's one irony. The second irony is that Kennedy and Walker are on different political sides of the aisle, and yet Lee Oswald is such a loose cannon, if I can use that term here, that he's taking shots at everybody. He's chasing fame, it seems like. I'd like your thoughts on that.
Those are really good points that you made about the nature of Oswald as an assassin. And when we wrote this book, what we really wanted to do is to sort of immerse you in the times as much as possible. You know, we used a lot of primary documents, so there's a good amount of dialogue, and you sort of feel like you're a fly on the wall at times when you're in these scenes. Because of that, we didn't really do a lot of overt analysis. And you raise a really good point about the nature of Lee Harvey Oswald and how this guy who shot at this far right-wing general would later turn his attention to what many considered a far-left president, although, of course, as history tells us, JFK was a pretty moderate president. That's real irony. And it's something that we kind of grappled with, too, because when you look at this really heated environment in Dallas, our contention is that you have this guy, Oswald, who's pretty unstable emotionally. He's got above-average intelligence. He's a pretty bright fellow. He's still really an adolescent. He's, you know, in his early 20s. He's not been able to find a place in society for himself. You know, he tried in Russia, tried to defect. And of course, he was a miserable failure as a communist in Russia. He came kind of crawling back to the U.S. And he was somebody who psychologically wanted to have prominence. He wanted to see his name in the papers. He wanted a place on the stage. He was really attracted to Dallas because it was the center of this really kind of violent-tinged movement. Dallas was the capital of America's far-right movement at the time. So he was naturally drawn to General Walker. And the question is, as a communist, why would he go after this left-wing president? That presupposes that these assassins think logically. And all you have to do is look at people like Kinkley, who shot at Ronald Reagan. Before he shot at Reagan, earlier he had stalked Jimmy Carter. Mark David Chapman, who shot at John Lennon, also had people like Walter Cronkite on his list of targets. So it's not so much these assassins aren't as ideologically rigorous as we would like them to be. They're just really kind of looking for very prominent people where they can make as big of a splash as possible.
I think it's interesting to go back and look at what happened and consider the times. I did not realize that Dallas was a boiling cauldron. It's interesting you say immerse yourself in the time. I told my wife as I was reading this book, I said, I cannot put this thing down. And the reason that I can't is that with every page I turned, see, I knew what the conclusion of this was. I knew where it was leading. But yet I still continued as a reader to walk down that road, because I think you guys did a masterful job of pointing out exactly what a boiling cauldron of hatred that place was on all sides. I mean, Dallas was really something, wasn't it, in that time period?
Oh, yeah, it really was. It's extraordinary to think, you know, especially as we look back with our kind of gauzy, nostalgic view of the early 60s, but it was a place where people were really devoted to taking down the president, and it makes our hyper-partisan ideological battles today seem all too familiar, somewhat depressingly. Dallas, it was the leading citizens who were taking on Kennedy, and I'll just mention one briefly. This is a guy, Ted Dealey. You may recognize that last name, Dealey, because the Dealey Plaza is named for his family, and he was the newspaper publisher in Dallas. And his rancor towards JFK was so pronounced that he was not content merely to denounce the president as a communist in the pages of his newspaper, but he actually traveled to Washington, D.C. and visited Kennedy in the White House, took part in a social event there, and basically got in JFK's face and told the president something along the lines of, America's looking for a man on horseback to lead this nation, and too many of us in Texas and the Southwest think you're riding Caroline's tricycle. Just that kind of intense combativeness was really what Dallas was all about. The city was doing very well economically. There was a lot of oil money, and it was pretty smug with its sense of growth and progress, and felt like the federal government was nothing but a hindrance, really, to doing business. And so these people felt that, you know, they had the economic power and the clout to really kind of contest Kennedy for control of the country.
The folks that you talk about in this book, were you aware before you started doing it that this story was this full of colorful characters? And if you can, give me a couple that you were introduced to that sort of surprised you as we talk about Dallas 1963, but really 1960 through 63, but the title of your book, Dallas 1963.
Well, you know, when we started doing this book, part of our attraction was to find out more about who these people were, because we'd heard a little bit over the years about some of these kind of really kooks who had made Dallas infamous for the assassination. There's a reason that people blamed Dallas for Kennedy's death, and it's because of these people. And, you know, we talked about General Walker, who very little really was known about other than what had been reported in the papers. And so we had a chance to go into his archive. Got dozens of boxes of his materials at the University of Texas in Austin. So we were able to really look from the inside and see what was motivating him and driving him. We got lots of good detail about him, too. One of the most infamous things that happened in Dallas was the day the president arrived. He was greeted by a huge crowd of admirers and people cheering him. At the same time, there were thousands of copies of this flyer distributed on the streets of Dallas. And this flyer showed two pictures of Kennedy arranged to look like a mugshot. You know, there was a frontal shot and then a side view of the president. And under the pictures, it said, wanted for treason. And then under that, it listed all these reasons why JFK was considered an enemy of the state, an enemy of America. And it was General Walker who produced this flyer in conjunction with his chief lieutenant, a man I did not know about until we started investigating. But this guy, as it turns out, was the head of the American Nazi Party in Dallas. And so to find that all these Nazis were running around in the middle of all of this, and, you know, they were putting swastikas on the stores, like, one of the heroes of our book is a guy named Stanley Marcus, who, pretty well known at the time, he was the head of Neiman Marcus. It was his family's business. And he was the man who did more than anybody to really try to bring a sense of reason and tolerance to Dallas. Among other things, he invited United Nations Ambassador Adlai Stevenson to come to the city in October 1963. And Stanley Marcus did this because he thought so many people were claiming that Kennedy plans to surrender control of our country to the United Nations, which is communist-controlled, that if everybody saw Adlai Stevens, very erudite, well-spoken man, at that event is General Walker's crowd basically stormed the auditorium. They heckled Adlai Stevenson mercilessly during the event. And when it was over, a group of about 100 or so protesters were left over, and they basically charged after Stevenson. People were throwing punches at him, spitting on him. He was hit over the head with a picket sign. Stanley Marcus pushed him into a getaway car that was briefly rocked by the crowd before it was able to actually drive away from the event. Adlai Stevenson, you know, was wiping the spit off of his face. He asked, "My God, are these human beings or are these animals?"
We visit with Stephen L. Davis, Dallas 1963, the book that he co-authored along with Bill Minutaglio, and it's available from 12 Publishing, and I'd recommend it to you. Dallas 1963, and that aforementioned depiction of John Kennedy wanted for treason, in fact, adorns the cover of this work, and I would encourage you to pick it up. One thought, who in their right mind would think that it is a good idea to send a president into that environment? And here's the irony. The irony is they were concerned about the right wingers. The guy that ends up shooting at him has an ideology that's on the other side of the spectrum, as we've already pointed out. But who was to know? But my question is, we just back it up here from the lens of time. Why would you send a president into that environment? And your book points out that there were folks warning.
Oh, yeah.
Elaborate on that.
So many people were warning Kennedy not to go to Dallas. Among them was Adlai Stevenson. As we mentioned, a month before Kennedy's own visit had been attacked in the city, there were people in Texas sending letters. Stanley Marcus, who we talked about a moment ago, contacted his good friend Lyndon Johnson, the vice president, and told him to please tell the president to cancel his visit. Dallas isn't safe. And yet Kennedy came. And if you think about why Kennedy chose to come, and why it was really never even a question for him to not come, this is a growing American city that had been hijacked by far-right extremists who basically were trying to sort of declare their own independent republic again, in a way. And they chased out his UN ambassador. Kennedy had a lot of qualities, and one certainly was his courage and his grace under pressure. And there was no way that he was going to surrender that part of the United States to the extremists. He had every intention of coming into Dallas. We talk about the speech he planned to give in Dallas that day, where he basically took on the far right and talked about how it was easy to come up with simple slogans and criticisms. It was a lot harder to actually govern a diverse country with many different competing interests. There was no way that he was going to not come. And as you pointed out, you know, everybody was focused on the far right, because these were the people who had been the most violent in their opposition. There was not much of a far left in Dallas. And, of course, there was Oswald, the loner, and he certainly had been the subject of interest from the FBI. They did not investigate him very thoroughly, as we know. And even if they had, he was a wife beater, which was terrible, but he had not really shown any kind of propensity towards violence in society. And so he just, you know, never really rose up on the radar. He was kind of a nobody. Nobody really paid attention to him. And when Kennedy got shot, first reaction was everybody was sure that somebody on the far right had done it. And in fact, one of the kind of chilling things that we reported in the book is after the news came out, the president had been shot, but before anybody knew who had done it, the phone was ringing off the hook at Dallas Police Headquarters. And these were housewives from Dallas who were calling, and each one of them was sobbing and distraught, telling the police she was certain that it had been her husband who had shot the president that day. That tells you what kind of climate JFK was going into.
You guys paint that picture leading up. And of course, like you said, we have the lens here of history that we're looking at. So we're way pulled back off what transpired. But yet at the same time, you look at that and go, geez, that's just not wise.
Well, Kennedy planned to go to Chicago earlier that month, and there were serious security considerations for that visit, too. And in fact, that trip got canceled. And if you think about the 1960 election, you know, the very close cliffhanger election between Kennedy and Richard Nixon, mm-hmm. It came down to two states, Illinois and Texas. And they both went for Kennedy by the slimmest of margins. So it was vitally important that he campaign in both. both states. So he was already upset about having to miss his visit to Illinois.
Let's go back to the Walker assassination attempt. There was no idea that this was Lee Oswald until after the fact, but Walker suspected, didn't he, that Oswald did this. He suspected it after the fact. Why was that?
I'm glad you asked, because we didn't have enough room in the book to really go into the investigation of the attempt against Walker. Because Walker, for a long time, was sure that it had been an inside job. It had been one of his so-called supporters, and he actually hired private detectives to track down this man named William Duff, who had been kind of a drifter, ne'er-do-well, who hung out with General Walker for a few months, and then had sort of been fired from his job as a volunteer. And then a couple weeks later is when this happened. So there was a lot of suspicion against this guy. In Walker's archive, you can see the questioning that was done of the suspect and things like that. And of course, publicly, Walker is saying there must have been somebody on the far left who had done it, a communist, which of course turned out to be exactly right. None of these people had small egos. So for somebody like General Walker, who I will say was not in Dallas on November 22nd, he actually knew that it was time to retreat. So he left the state. He was actually in Louisiana talking to different white supremacist groups. But when he heard that this communist had killed the president, then it was a safe assumption for him to make that this communist would have come after him as well. So I don't think it was any extraordinary leap of genius on Walker's part, but it was a pretty smart assumption that he made. And he was quite a strategist and tactician.
Why is the Walker story not pushed more to the fore by folks who have a conventional view, Lee Harvey Oswald acting alone? It seems as if that would help bolster their case. And as you've done some research, let me ask you about the cottage industry that is the assassination industry in Dallas. Does that help them to keep this alive, to keep the questions out there?
The cottage assassination industry
sure,
in Dallas?
Sure. Folks that will go just to see the scenes, to see the site, to see the book depository, that sort of thing.
Well, Dallas was humiliated that this happened in their city. It was a huge black mark. And as we mentioned earlier, they were blamed worldwide and still are in many circles decades later for the Kennedy assassination. In a way that Memphis was never really blamed for Martin Luther King's assassination, or L.A. was never blamed for Bobby Kennedy's. So the people in Dallas would be all too happy to erase any memory of the assassination. And they tried to do that, actually. The book depository where the shots came from was slated to be torn down, and the idea was really to just eradicate any memory of that awful event. But what happened is some forward-thinking people came together and realized that this really needed to be preserved because it is important history. And that same building, which it sounds like you visited, Tony, that now houses the Sixth Floor Museum, which is, I would say, a very honorable way to address Kennedy's assassination and his legacy. It's really the best you could hope for. It's a very classy museum. It doesn't shy away from any explanations, although obviously it doesn't engage in a lot of the wilder conspiracy. It takes pretty much the Warren Commission view. But it's a really kind of cathartic thing, I think, for people to come and actually be at the place where that happened.
Part of what I do is I live in the sports realm, okay? And so we talk a lot of NFL and things like that. You mentioned earlier in our conversation H.L. Hunt. The Hunt name should be extremely familiar to football fans. H.L. Hunt, correct me if I'm wrong, is the father of Lamar Hunt, who is the father of the AFL and a guy who, to the end of his life, was known as one of the classiest people in American sport. And my question for you would be, how in the world did Lamar Hunt come from H.L. Hunt?
And that's such a nice observation you made about Lamar Hunt, who I totally agree. He's the guy who invented the Super Bowl, certainly coined the term Super Bowl to describe that game, and brought professional tennis and Major League Soccer to the U.S. in a lot of ways, had a great legacy. And as far as being a son of H.L. Hunt, H.L. Hunt had at least two and quite possibly three concurrent marriages, different wives, different children in different cities while this stuff was going on while he's piously attending church, denouncing Kennedy as being evil. The other children and grandchildren turned out very different from the old man. But, you know, he was that first generation of person in a family to make a lot of money. And he lost a lot of money. You know, he went broke a few times before he finally really made it big and became, you know, a billionaire. And people like that, they're very protective of what they've acquired. So any perceived threat, be it from the government or anybody else, is met pretty forcefully.
And H.L. Hunt, I mean, let's not fool ourselves. This guy was crazy out loud crazy. I'm looking at the back and the post-credits in your book, which I love because I found as I was reading the book, I would go to the post-credits and say, okay, now, this person I'm reading about here, what is their place in the story? Because me not being from that area, it helped to, and I'm sure that's why you did this, but I just want to read a snippet of what you write about H.L. Hunt here. Remained a target of conspiracy theorists, became increasingly interested in health issues as he aged, began the practice of, quote, creeping, crawling on the floor, which he told astonished visitors helped keep him young. So here you would ring this guy's doorbell, and he would creep on the floor over to you. What in the world would have gotten into that guy? And then he told an interviewer at the age of 81 that he intended to live to be 140, like people live in a certain tribe in the Himalayas, but he ended up dying at the age of 85, so he didn't quite get to his 140-year age mark. I mean, that guy sounds like an absolute fruitcake.
Oh, yeah. And those are great pieces that you picked out to talk about H.L. Hunt. And he's also the guy who used his fortune to basically try to educate Americans politically. You know, he had that talk show that aired across the country, and that's the one where when John Kennedy proposed Medicare, Hunt's announcers said that, you know, Medicare would lead to government death panels. Hunt wrote a novel about a fictional country, the perfect constitution. And of course, in H.L. Hunt's view, the perfect constitution would provide rich people far more votes than poor people would receive. And so there's kind of no end to his insanity, really.
Another guy that I want to touch on here on the way out, as we visit today with Stephen L. Davis, the book is Dallas 1963 from 12 Publishing. It is a really, really interesting look at what was going on in Dallas from 1960 through 1963, which of course was the year that John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Robert Suri, the guy who was the source of the Wanted for Treason pamphlet, this guy's kind of a footnote. I wonder what it was like for him through all those years in his life to have put Kennedy's face on that pamphlet. I guess we'll never know, but that had to be a tough thing for him to live with, the aftermath of what happened there.
I don't think it bothered him at all, to be honest, Tony. From the readings I've got of Robert Suri, from reading his testimony to the FBI, the other documents I've come across that really give you insight into who he is and the way he approached life. This is the guy who was the head of the American Nazi Party in Dallas. He was General Walker's chief assistant. And in fairness to General Walker, he only knew that Suri was very conservative, just as he was. He didn't realize that he had become so conservative, he had become a Nazi. And Suri is the guy who, I think, was quite able to rationalize the fact that the president was killed by a list and had nothing at all to do with this flyer that he produced. I think that's just the way he approached life.
Is there anything else, Stephen, that we haven't touched on regarding this book that you feel like we need to point out? And go ahead and do that, if you will.
One person we didn't really talk about much was Congressman Bruce Alger, sole Republican in the Texas delegation at that time, representing Dallas. He was the most conservative congressman in Washington. He's the guy who, when Congress voted to provide free milk at lunchtime for needy school children, Bruce Alger was the only person to vote against it. He said that was godless communism. He sort of had some memorable actions in Dallas. And again, this is something that's really been under the radar for years and really deserves to be seen as a lot more consequential. And that is his role in what's been called the Mink Coat Mob. This basically was 4 days before the 1960 election. Nixon was leading in the polls in Texas over Kennedy, and Kennedy sent his running mate, Lyndon Johnson, to Texas to try to scare up some more votes. LBJ came to Dallas with his wife, Lady Bird, and they were met by this kind of astonishing mob of very very well-dressed, very hostile, and ultimately quite violent people who were Dallas's leading citizens. Many of the women were wearing mink coat mobs. And they were led by Bruce Alger, who was holding up a sign that said, LBJ sold out to Yankee socialists, and the crowd sort of attacked Lyndon and Lady Bird. They were, you know, spat upon. People were pushing at them, swinging picket signs at them. And this whole melee was caught by television news cameras. And when that footage aired, Walter Cronkite and other newscasters aired it on their evening programs. And people were just astonished at this hatred and this ugliness emanating from these seemingly cultured people in an otherwise respectable American city. And this protest led by Alger caused a backlash against Nixon in the South and in Texas, and made him ultimately lose the race in Texas. And we have evidence of that from Richard Nixon's own White House recordings, where after he became elected president, you know, he's talking about what happened in the 1960 election and tells one of his aides, well, we lost Texas in 1960 because of that a-hole congressman in Dallas.
I'm telling you, this book is just really gripping. As you say, we have a tendency to look back at those times and go, most of the film's in black and white. It was such a quaint time. Why do we have the level of discourse we have now? Nothing can be further from the truth. If anything, it sort of parallels the time that we live in. No matter what side of the aisle you're on, you sort of look at it and you go, yeah, there's really nothing new under the sun, as Ecclesiastes likes to say. And Stephen, on the way out, I really do appreciate the time. Now let me ask you, and really this isn't the focal point of your book, in fact, it's not even touched on, do you buy that there was any other involvement by anyone other than Oswald when it came to killing the president?
So there we are, you know, the million-dollar question. We had a chance to really, as I mentioned, look at a lot of primary documents, to really study Oswald, his personality, and his capabilities. And at the end, I came to believe the same thing that Oswald's brother believes. And his view is, yes, he did it. He was a loner by nature. It was just one of those crazy things in history where all the forces are aligned for something like that to happen. Those things happen. You know, and actually you can look at almost any event in great detail and you can see all the seeming inconsistencies that make up our perceptions of what happened. That's just part of the world that we live in.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. In fact, when I read your book, I just kind of said, you know, it just doesn't make any sense that the shooter would come from his ideology in light of everything that was going on in that city, unless he were just, as this guy was, a complete nut job that wanted attention. He was a complete loser that wanted to make his mark in the world.
Exactly. I think you just described Lee Harvey Oswald and probably some other assassins as well.
Stephen, thank you so much for your time today, and I want to encourage the listener to please go out and check out Dallas 1963 from 12 Books, Bill Minutiaglio, I will butcher his name forevermore, and Stephen L. Davis. Stephen, thank
you.
Great
talking to you.
Great talking to you, thanks.
Take care.
Stephen L. Davis, one more time, I really thank him for his time. Terrific spending a few minutes with him today. Hey, check that book out. As far as I'm concerned, you read this, you'll go, wow, that is a fascinating book. Hope you enjoyed today's edition of Book Corner.